call the House Committee on Economic Development, Trade, and Tourism together. Let the record reflect, the time is 5:20. Today is Tuesday, April 24th. Present is Representative Dahl, Dugan, Lynn, and myself, Chair Newman. Representative Coring has been excused, as is Representative Gatto. On the agenda today is the economics of sport fishing in Alaska. And we're going to have a presentation on Agrium's economic impact on the Kenai following. But right now, with the economics of sport fishing, I want to thank Ricky Geese for being willing to start the conversation. He's going to be doing a presentation. Ricky, please state your name.
My name is Ricky Geese. I'm the executive director of Kenai River Sport Fishing Association. We're a 501c3 nonprofit fishery conservation organization on the Kenai Peninsula, and we're dedicated to keeping the Kenai River as one of the world's premier sport fishing rivers. Just like to introduce a few members who came down. Here to be with us today from our board is our board chair, Rick Busey, Bob Penny, Shirley Gifford, Ron Rainey, Bill McKay, Reuben Henke, and Jim Golden from our board of directors.
And Ricky,
and Elmer Balder.
Members, there is a copy of this presentation in your packet. Ricky, I'm just going to have the members go ahead, and if they have questions along the way through your presentation, and it's 10 slides or so, just go ahead, committee members. We're going to be a little bit informal on this, and just go ahead and ask questions of Ricky.
Sure, and this is an informal presentation just to bring everybody informational. Not really here asking for any specific things on any House bills or anything like that, but just to bring everybody up to date on where we are in terms of the size and scope of sport fishing in Alaska. So sport fishing in Alaska is a $1 billion industry. Its total economic output as judged in 2003 dollars from the Fish and Wildlife Survey that was done in 01 puts at about a $1 billion economic output. In the Kenai Peninsula borough, it's about $650 million. Statewide, it produces about 11,000 annual average jobs and brings in about $250 million in payroll per year. So one of the things we'll talk a little bit about today is the size and scope of it, but for a $1 billion industry, one of the things that we'll talk about a little bit later in the presentation is the real lack of up-to-date and comprehensive information on a real-time basis coming in year to year. The surveys that are done, the state last did a large survey back in 1993. And it's a $1 billion industry, and we should be having more information on more of a real-time basis here.
Rick, if you just excuse me for a minute, we have been joined by Representative Johansson for the record. And Ricky, when we're looking at this $1 billion industry, this $1 billion number, you know, most people think of sport fishing as something that's done when the waters aren't frozen. But I'm an avid ice fisherman myself too. Does this include those numbers of people who get out and spend?
Yes, it does.
Time
it's year-round, yeah. Okay, so a little quote from Theodore Roosevelt here. Who pays for conservation? In a civilized and cultivated country, wild animals only continue to exist when preserved by sportsmen. The excellent people who protest against all hunting and consider sportsmen as enemies of wildlife do not understand the fact that in reality, the genuine sportsman is, by all odds, the most important factor in keeping the larger and more valuable wild creatures from total extermination. And Theodore Roosevelt is near and dear to our heart because he was the impetus behind the founding of the Kenai National Moose Range back at the turn of the century. And we agree with the sentiments expressed 100 years ago. They're still true today. And we extend this on to anglers. Anglers pay for their fair share of conservation in the state of Alaska. In 1993, there was 483,000 licenses sold that generated $13 million in revenue. Of that $13 million, $9.6 million was generated from non-resident licenses. In 2006, we had almost 500,000 licenses sold, generated $21 million in revenue. The additional fees Starting in 06, of that $21 million, $6.8 was going to pay off the facility bonds to support the hatcheries, the new hatcheries that are going in on the state. It's also, there are taxes on recreational equipment for angling. It generates about $16 million. That money goes into the ADF&G budget to pay for fishery conservation efforts across Alaska with stock assessment programs and restoration projects. Anglers are among the nation's most ardent conservationists and spend time and effort to introduce children and other newcomers to the enjoyment of the outdoors. It's actually much of what we do in our organization. We have programs like Hooked on Fishing, where we get kids involved in fishing in a young age, give a kid a fishing pole, and you bring to them a lifetime of memories. One of the things that's critical for this billion-dollar industry in our state is access, infrastructure, and allocation. Public access and allocation for anglers to utilize the state and federal fish resources is critical for the recreational economy. If we don't have access to the public resource, you can't go fishing. And if there's no fish in the rivers to fish for, you're kind of straining water there. And it's important that we recognize that we need to have access and allocation for these fisheries to sustain themselves. Basic infrastructure such as boardwalks, trails, and boat launches must be developed and maintained to provide reasonable access while protecting the habitat. And as one of the things that's happening in our state and we're seeing on the Kenai River is a closure through private properties, either being subdivided out, where we traditionally had trail access to rivers and streams, or through boat launches that may have been in private hands, but they may turn over. And we need to invest in a system of public boat launches across through South Central in our area. We're losing access to these rivers. And what's getting frustrating for the common anglers is that you're now spending an hour or 2 hours to access river systems, whereas before, prior to the closure of some of these private boat launches, the numbers may not have switched that much, but we're putting more and more pressure on our public access points, and we need to secure those and have more of those public access points.
And Ricky, you've talked, or there is some legislation that's in this body that talks about access to river streams and banks. Are you familiar with that?
Yes, and we're very supportive of that legislation. That legislation would require DNR and ADF&G to prioritize those river systems in Alaska that need to have public access and to seek out voluntary easements from private property owners and to dedicate money towards that to purchase up those easements and maintain those easements. The other thing that we see happening is for example, on the Kasiloff River, it's the twin river system to the Kenai. We have a public boat launch, which puts people into the river on the Kasiloff for a very important drift fishery, but there's no public takeout. And currently, the one takeout that's in private hands is up for sale. And if that went away, we'd have a system with an input but no output. So you could get in the river, but then you're kind of stuck there, and you're not going to paddle drift back upstream. You know, it's a one-way journey going downstream. So if we don't secure these in a reasonable fashion, the basic infrastructure that allows that drift fishery to exist will go away.
And excuse me, Ricky, we have been joined by Representative Johansson in the audience. Thank you.
So we have a need for access and infrastructure and allocation. And one of the things that's important for legislators like yourself, for people sitting on the Board of Fisheries or the North Pacific Fisheries Management Council, is just basic economic information, real-time information, so you understand and have the information that shows you the size and the importance of sport fishing to the recreational economy here, to the quality of life of Alaskans. And when decisions are made, what those impacts will be in real numbers. Because without that information, some decisions can be made that will be detrimental to the health of this industry. So fishing is a major economic driver for the tourism industry, and we have people online who can testify on that and in the audience here. Many Alaskans rely on fishing for recreational and consumptive uses. On the Kenai River, we have a personal use dip net fishery that 21,000 households in South Central make use of. Outdoor recreation is a major component of the quality of life for our residents. It's one of the top reasons why people enjoy living in Alaska. It's what separates us with our wealth of fish and game resources from many areas of the rest of the world. And we think it's very important to have up-to-date, comprehensive economic information on a billion-dollar industry, and yet this information is scarce. Again, as I mentioned earlier, the major ADF&G study was done in 93, and Fish and Wildlife does it on about every 5 years.
Representative Dugan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So there hasn't been a major study since 1993.
From the state side.
Have they been updating the 93 study then?
No, what you're left with is that, you know, if you're going to talk about the size of the economic output of sport fishing, you're left to basically just adjust for inflation. And if you don't do regular surveys, then you don't know if an industry is growing, if it's constricting.
Representative Dugan, and by the way, Representative Dugan, there has been some money put into last year's budget to do an economic impact survey in the Mat-Su Borough District or the Northern Cook Inlet District.
I see.
Representative Dugan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And is the lack of this survey a function of funding or a function of interest, or
it's a function of recording information? Basically, we have and updating information and just putting it on the radar screen, saying that this is important information. It can be useful to you as legislators when we look at access projects. If you're trying to make decisions on whether a $3 million investment for a public takeout is important, well, if that $3 million allows a $20 or a $25 million industry to continue, then you can start saying, yeah, that would be important as an investment. So what we have is we have numbers of visitors, we have numbers of licenses, but the economic output in the modeling that needs to get done hasn't been done in a systematic way to date. Now, there are efforts going forward. We have ADF&G is working, I think it's with Southwick Associates, and they're coming in to look at Upper Cook Inlet and then to look at the Southeast charter industry to provide some modeling on that. NOAA is trying to do more of an annual basis, both from the commercial fishing industry and for the sport fishing industry. And Gunnar Knapp from ICER is going to do an analysis this year, both on the commercial, sport fishing, personal use, and subsistence, to find out where our data gaps are and what can be done. So it's understood that this is a need that we need to solve and to get better information both on our sport fishing side and our commercial fishing side, and because it's important that we have real time data for people to make decisions on.
Representative Johansson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. came in a little late, so you may have already gone over this, so I apologize, but on the first page, it talks about total economic output of $1 billion, and on the slide it says comprehensive economic information on this billion-dollar industry is scarce. How did you build that $1 billion? Was that simply, as you said, growing with
inflation? Well, the last information that we have access to is 01.
Could you explain how you came up with that,
though?
Oh,
how
okay.
How do you get to $1 billion, basically?
So this is the Fish and Wildlife Survey is in 01, and this is the last major economic survey that was done in the state, you know, about 6 years ago. And so you take the total output in 01 and you just adjust for inflation. That's about the only thing we can do to try and get some numbers for today.
Representative Jansen.
Yeah. Just based on the growth of the charter industry in Ketchikan, based on the cruise passenger increase, you know, that's a big number, but it may be lowballing the whole thing. So it'll be interesting to find the actual numbers.
That's correct, and that's one of the problems when you don't do this in a real-time basis. You can't track the growth. And that's one of the issues in front of the North Pacific Fisheries Management Council now, is that you have the growth in that charter industry. It's impacting allocations between the longline industry and the charter industry. And if we don't have any numbers to show the total scope on both those industries, we're left with kind of a Ouija board and trying to figure out what to do.
And just one more, Mr. Chair.
Go ahead.
On this this document right here, it's has information on South Central. It looks like it was just extracted from a larger report. Is that correct?
And that's correct.
Just because that's the area that you guys are from.
One of the documents that's available on our website, it's the economic values of sport, personal use, commercial salmon fishing in Upper Cook Inlet. And we surveyed a bunch of different data, and the two main sources of economic data were that study that was done by ICER in 93. And again, you can just update information or roll it forward. And then also the Fish and Wildlife Survey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you.
So, again, this comes down to the lack of information does not necessarily lead to informed public policy. And without that up-to-date comprehensive economic data, the central role of sport angling in the state's economy will continue to be underestimated and sometimes taken lightly in public policy decisions. And one thing that I also want to point on this in terms of a lack of information is one of the studies that came out recently on the growing Alaskan retirement community, now contributing through pensions and other funds that they have access to over $2 billion annually to our state economy. If you think to yourself, what's probably the top three reasons why people will retire to Alaska and stay here? Access to the fish and game resources here is very fundamental and important to that. And what we've seen in our community is a major investment in healthcare systems in our Central Peninsula Hospital. We now have a new over $100 million facility put in there, and it's servicing this growing segment of our state's economy and our community.
I think that can be said statewide, you know, for what's going on. It's a model that can be tracked statewide, certainly in the Mansu.
So we feel that, the more information we have, the more representation we have on regulatory boards and commissions of people who are familiar with the sport fishing industry can bring a balance and fairness to the regulatory decisions. But we think that it's just important. One of the things that we really want to get across is that this economic information is really valuable, and it can help you all in your places as legislators and also people on the Board of Fisheries and the North Pacific Fisheries Management Council.
Thank you, Ricky. Do we have any specific questions for Ricky? Going to be hearing some other public comment too, and so hopefully we'll have some questions for those. Thank you, Ricky, and we'll bring you back if we have some more questions. Representative Lynn, did you have questions?
No, I did not.
Okay. We're going to go to OffNet right now, and we'll go to Bruce Knowles. Bruce, are you there for some public comment?
Yes, I'm here.
Go ahead, Bruce. State your name for the record.
I hope you'll forgive me. I'm recovering from major surgery down here in Seattle. One thing I would like to speak with, if people would check, Cook Inlet provides only 3% of the annual statewide salmon harvest for sockeye. They are a small player in the statewide process. And yet they're the only major player for sockeye in the inlet. And that's what controls the whole livelihood of Cook Inlet. And that's where we run into trouble. Because when you have fish moving through the inlet, catching the sockeyes, you wind up catching everything from king salmon to chums to pinks, silvers, and there is so little knowledge that the Department of Fish and Game has admitted this year that they cannot do an accurate forecast until after the 22nd of the month, not a real good one until after the 25th. And this came out in some papers that were published back in January and February, and as part of the transition team, we received those. So that is something that needs to be looked at. We need to discover a way to get a good system-wide, Cook Inlet-wide method of identifying when the stocks are coming through. And hopefully this new genetic study that we're doing is going to help with that, and the state should have the results of that in late summer, early fall. And that way we can determine when the sockeyes are moving through the central district coming north, because that's where most of our stocks get killed. And looking at the forecast for this year, we are going to be below minimums on our two escapement goals that we have in the northern district for sockeye. But sport fishermen in the upper valley have been shut off from sockeye two out of the last 3 years because of poor returns forecasted by the department. And the personal use depth fishery has not been had for over 12 years. So we're suffering from the poor returns coming back for sockeye. So we're having to make do with other species. The chum salmon coming through to the northern district has dropped from 1.2 million in 1986 to less than 74,000 the last 2 years. And this is not even, no studies have ever been documented or conducted in Upper Cook Inlet of any value for chum salmon or pinks. Selective streams have had coho done, and selective streams have had kings done. But it's a desert of knowledge up there that we have to get done so that we can actually do a good job of knowing when the fish are going through and the department can do a viable study.
Thank you, Bruce. Are you done?
Well, I was just going to say that the sport fishing industry in the northern district relies on the hatcheries that's just been they're being built, and they're going to suffer the losses because in the next year or two they're going to have to quit putting fish in at Willow because the hatcheries are behind, and it looks like the power plant at Eklutin are going to have to get put back, and no fish going in there because of delay in the hatchery building, and the people of Alaska have become dependent on those. And the average Alaskan is called a sport fisherman. When they take their rod and reel, go to the river to catch a fish, they're a sport fisherman, when in reality they're consumptive users, and they're beat about the head and shoulders because they go out there and they harvest fish with a rod and reel. They're they're sport fishermen. And this way they have managed to say, well, they don't have to have those fish. They're out there enjoying themselves. So I think we need to have a new type of sportsman that is classed as a consumptive user, and that's an Alaskan that goes to the river to take foods home to eat. So that's what I've got to say.
Thank you, Bruce. And Bruce referred a little bit to the delay in the hatcheries. Notice that, of course, that money came from the increase in fishing licenses that was supported last year, passed through the body. Bruce, why are the fisheries or the hatcheries being delayed? Do you know?
What have you? I don't know. I know that the department is working fairly hard at getting them done. There's been problems with getting water, the right type of water, with enough land to do the jobs correctly. Okay. You know, you can get water, but it's subject to where they get bugs that'll kill the fish that get in, and there's not enough flow and all of this. And I've been working with the Matt Thubura of trying to get where they would donate land with the right type of water, and so there's still discussions going on.
Yeah, thanks, Bruce. We've got Doug Vincent Lang from Alaska Department of Fish and Game here for the committee members too to ask questions. Maybe Doug can answer that for us later on. And Bruce, get well, my friend, and give us a call. And for the committee members too, who want to learn a little bit more about Northern Cook Inlet, if you want to get a hold of me, I'll get you Bruce's name, and he can tell you anything that you would ever want to know. Thanks, Bruce.
I'll be back home Thursday.
Thanks, my friend. Give me a call.
All righty.
Greg Sutter from Alaska Charters.
Yes, thank you, Chairman and gentlemen. I do appreciate this opportunity. I just wanted to stress the fact, too, about what Mr. Geese was saying, that a lot of the economic studies done on tourism and the related sport fishing industry. And am I off the line?
No, you're there.
Okay, I'm hearing something in the background. A lot of the studies done on the economic data are really outdated, and the sport fishing industry, even though we are related to the fisheries, we're more related to tourism because we do help attract a great many visitors to our state, as well as be able to service residents of the state so they can gain access and enjoy the resource. It's a very safe and industry, and it's based upon our renewable resources. We have five major industries in the state, and all of you are very, very much aware of them. That's oil, mineral, timber, commercial fishing, and tourism. And since it is based on renewable resources and it is a very clean industry, we should do as much as we can to be able to gauge what economic impact this industry is truly having on our state. And we should have up-to-date data. And I personally believe that so far as the future of Alaska, tourism will play an ever-increasing role, and we should be able to determine at least where we are right now and update all the economic studies and get as much data on it as possible. And there are other reasons as well. As fishery managers, we're dealing with a lot of issues, and I'm sure Mr. Vincent Lang will let you know about some of those, but when we talk about restricting boats in the fleet, and this could be on the commercial side as well as the charter side, with limited entry programs and moratoriums, we need to be able to weigh the factors out and what kind of impact that will have on tourism, as well as restrictions on anglers with bag limits and allocation issues. So all this data can come in very, very handy for a variety of reasons. And the biggest thing about encouraging tourists to the state, it really does help the economy in general. You know, my operation is a small operation. I have one boat. It's considered a six-pack boat. And about 50% of my growth goes right back into the local economy as expenses from my operation. That's for gear, tackle, engine repairs, electrical, electronics, fiberglassing, woodworking. A lot of people, when they come into town, they have their fish packaged and processed. Supports a lot of flayers, bed and breakfasts, motels, restaurants, even the bars, gift shops, grocery stores, convenience stores. You're getting an idea of how long the list goes, and it goes right on to airlines and cruise ships, water taxis, fly-in services, and the list gets very long, and the logistical support for each one of those related businesses is very long, too. And therefore, the economic contribution that we have to the state is very significant. And I do urge you gentlemen to really look at getting a full comprehensive social economic study done for the state of Alaska, and let's look at all of the data when we make decisions affecting tourism and related sport fishing industries. Thank you.
Thank you, Greg. And you mentioned gentlemen, but we do have some very distinguished ladies in this body, too. And Greg touched on something, and I'd like the other committee members, this committee members, too, and maybe people in the industry. It is this chair's intention to go back and look at quotas. Go back a little bit and look at fishing quotas. Did they work like you're supposed to? How are they supposed to work? Well, there's been discussion, I know, in different committees and boards about fishing quotas on some of the charters, sports charters groups, and I've kind of been wanting to see what shakes out in some of these other boards But I think next year, this body needs to take a look at that, too, at the legislative level, and I think that that would be appropriate. Forewarned. Bob Howard from Homer. Bob, are you there?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I'm here. Can you hear me?
Yes, sir. Please state your name and affiliation for the record.
Okay. I am Bob Howard in Homer. I own a charter fishing business, and I serve as chair of the city's Economic Development Commission. But this evening I speak as a concerned citizen whose interest is seeing that this community has a strong economy that will improve the living standard of its residents. Sport fishing is an important economic element here in Homer. We operate the fishing hole, which is an enhanced salmon fishery, which is a large draw to many state residents as well as non-residents. We are home to a saltwater sport fishing fleet of more than 120 vessels. That fleet delivered more than 51,000 angler trips in 2006. This probably equates to somewhere in the neighborhood of $9 to $10 million of direct income to the charter businesses. And needless to say, probably at least that amount or more is spent by the tourists to secure food, lodging, local transportation, other entertainment, and many other ancillary services desired by the tourists. We need to support and promote sport fishing as a reliable, sustainable component of our tourism economy. Fishing is definitely a driving component for our tourist industry here in Homer. Without fishing, I don't think that we would enjoy near the economic strength that we have out of the tourist industry. We must maintain and increase our allocation of sustainable fish stocks for sport fishing. We must maintain and improve access to the fish and an appropriate level of marketing to attract users to take advantage of the annual harvest that is commensurate with maintaining sustainable stocks. Look, as a charter operator, I'm involved in halibut issues at the North Council, including allocation. We are sorely deficit in the comprehensive economic analysis, as Mr. Geese and Mr. Sutter has spoken to support the allocation decisions that are being made. It's extremely disappointing to me to see this very important resource, natural resource here in the state of Alaska that we're relying on very heavily to provide economic strength to this state, and we do not understand the economic impact of our decisions. And I think a comprehensive study is absolutely necessary for us to come to terms with how we are best utilizing this natural resource. That's the end of my testimony.
Thank you, Bob. Any questions for Bob? Thanks, Bob. Charles Petterman from Kodiak. Charles Petterman from Kodiak, are you there?
Charles Pierman. I go by Chaco Pierman. I'm from Kodiak, Alaska. I have a mom-and-pop charter operation here in Kodiak. I run a 53-foot charter boat. And I'm speaking. I also sit on a committee for the Knowledge Council that's dealing with some of the allocation issues that come up between commercial and charter.
Could you speak up, Chuck?
Certainly. We find ourselves in the midst of allocation discussions between sports fishing on charter boats and commercial fishing in southeast and south central Alaska. This issue is being discussed and plans are being developed to restrict sports fishermen without knowing what the economic impacts on our communities are going to be. For Kodiak and I'm going to read a little quote here off of NOAA Fisheries website. Specifically, the community of Kodiak has experienced multiple processing plant closures. Its residential workforce is at risk due to shorter and shorter processing seasons, and the community fish tax revenues should continue to decrease as fish prices and port landings decrease. Congress recognizes these problems and directed the Department of Commerce Secretary in consultation with the council to implement a rockfish pilot program. I say this because as we see more plant closures here and less product being landed here and the opportunities for commercial fishing declining in all of our fisheries, we seem to only have one area of growth in the private sector left to us, and that is in recreational fishing and tourism. We keep going down this road making allocation decisions and don't know what the economic impact on rural communities like mine are going to be. I think it's very critical that we have economic analysis done so that we can make sound decisions and don't make decisions in the blind, not knowing what the effects of it are going to be on our different communities. I know that we are a small part of the consumption of fisheries when you look at it on the big picture statewide. We're a remote destination, but that's one of the things that we offer that attracts certain people to come and see us. So I appreciate having gotten the opportunity to give some testimony and maybe contribute something that will lead to a positive outcome to doing some economic analysis so that we know what the effects, the decisions we're being asked to make are going to have on our community. And that's it for me. Thank you for allowing me to testify.
Thank you, Mr. Pittman. And again, hopefully we'll be able to hear from you again next year when we look at this a little bit further. Ron Wilson from Susitna Landing. Ron, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Go ahead, Ron.
Yeah, my name is Ron Wilson. I operate Ron's Riverboat Service. I also operate Susitna Landing, which is a boat ramp and campground. I'm board of directors on the Mat-Su Convention Visitors Bureau. And as far as the impact of sport fishing in this area, it brings in a vast income. That line to be taken care of. When I get called by clients or people that want to do a charter boat, they're drawn here for fishing, to go sport fishing. After that, they go, what else can we do? So after they get done sport fishing, they're going to be using rental cars, RVs, buying tackle, restaurants. It's the tourists are brought up here in the summertime, from my standpoint, a big part is sport fishing. I'm kind of fortunate with my clientele because most of them are Alaskans. Probably 70% of my charters every year are in-state Alaskans. So they're spending their money they earn in Alaska on industry that turns right around and gives it back because I'm buying gas, oil, parts. I operate a marine parts store up here also. So I'm selling boat parts, all to sport fishermen. And we have a growing industry of tourism up here of about 8%. I believe 7 to 8% a year, I think, is the average growth in tourism to the state of Alaska. And a big portion of that is for our sport fishing. So sport fishing is just, from my standpoint, what I'm seeing is, man, it's one of our, as far as I'm concerned, it's a major draw, you know, an income for the state. Any money generated through sport fishing, well, they say it goes through the economy about 7 times. So, I know to a lot of you guys, I'm probably preaching to the choir, but to me, sport fishing is very, very important, not only to the tourism, but to the consumptive user up here also. That's about all I got.
Ron, this is Ron Mark Newman here.
Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about, the last couple of years, the sockeye fishery has been closed. Can you talk tell us a little bit how that affects some of the people up there, the lodge owners? What are their options up there?
Well, what, to our stocks?
Yeah, about people coming back to go fishing again and the economic impact when they don't have the availability to take people out to catch sockeye.
Oh, heavens, yeah. I mean, it's we get a lot of our calls, one of the first things they want to ask is, where can I catch reds? And when the what we get up here is a lot of determined on a return into the Yetna. And every year they lower our escapement goals, and we have yet to meet one. They keep lowering them, and we still don't meet them. And we are at the end of the road up here for fish. We're kind of at the end of the food chain. And when they're intercepted out with the drift and set netters, when we have openings, our commercial openings, 2 to 3 days later after that opening, it's like somebody has turned a valve here in the Susitna drainage. Fish just stop. And the only time I've seen a big change is when I think some of the commercial fishermen didn't go out and they stayed in port. I think it was due to the price of fish. Holy smokes. I mean, we got blasted up here with fish, and it was great. They keep saying we have to watch having too many fish in the river. Well, I'd sure like to see it for a change. But, yeah, it's it has really caused a lack of people coming up because of just not being able to get to the sockeye and personal fisheries. Even our dip net that we used to have there in Wasilla, I think it's Fish Creek. No, we haven't had that for a long time. Our fish are being intercepted commercially. We can't get rid of the commercial fleet because we need them. But we need to regulate our returns a little better. And these studies, this genetic study that we're going to do, I think is going to help out a lot. And it'll take a lot of the guesswork and denial of who's intercepting what out on the high seas.
Okay, thanks, Ron. And Ron's right, too, with these fish studies, you know. There's been that constant, or consistent anyhow, talk of the interception of fish bound for Northern Cook Inlet by the commercial fishermen in Central District. And we're going to try and figure out where that's at this year or the next couple of years. And I think that's really going to prove where we're at, and it's going to go a long ways into solving that question, or at least maybe a couple more answers will come about that. Robert Mules from Tri-River Charters.
Yes, I'm here. My name is Robert Mules. I'm the owner of Tri-River Charters in Talkeetna. And I've been in the sport fishing business for about 25 years up here. And there's been quite a evolution, a transition that has taken place in our little town of Talkeetna the last 10 years. And that is we went from servicing in-state resident Alaskans to almost servicing out-of-state tourists exclusively. In the last 10 years, two large, one international corporation and one...
Speak a little louder, Robert.
And one native corporation have built some lodges up here. Cook Inlet Regional Corporation built a multi-million dollar facility the last number of years. And, of course, Princess Tours also built a very large facility, multi-million dollar facility up here. And they are... aggressively marketing their lodges to people from all over the United States and all over the world, and we are in a fortunate place up here that we're able to service their clientele with our sport fishing up here. The amount of money that is potentially coming into this area has been greatly increased due to the infrastructure that has been built by these international corporations, these multi-billion dollar corporations that have put it into this local area, this local economy, and we are reaping the benefits of that. I run a relatively small charter service. I have four boats. I hire four guides, three office staff, and myself. And we run charters, double charters, charters in the morning, charters in the afternoon, and we operate 7 days a week during the summer when we can. It provides an income for the guides. Some of my guides are local, and some of them are coming from out of state, but they're able to make a reasonable income up here. As fishing guides, and of course there's an awful lot of spin-off from that from the industry also with the local, as you all know, bed and breakfasts and restaurants and everything else. And it is in the well-being of our business is completely dependent upon, of course, us having fish up here. for a half-day charter, I charge $155, and in the fall, August, we're catching sockeye salmon, and we're limited to only two fish. And that equates to a value of $75 a fish. And there are some people who want to do all-day charters, and I charge $205 for that. So that means that each sockeye salmon to just me alone is worth $100. That prices those fish at a very high value to a small company. The other thing that's notable is that because I'm dealing with the large percentage of tourists, probably over 90% of my clients are tourists, a fair number of them, perhaps even the majority of them, are catching and releasing this fish because of the difficulty of getting the fish back frozen and taking it with them. Many of the people just opt to catch and release. So I'm making, you know, between $155 and $210 per person, and they're not impacting the resource whatsoever by returning the fish. This is a wonderful business that has grown up in the last number of years up here. The only thing that seems to be detrimental to it is, of course, when these fish are intercepted by the commercial fleets in Cook Inlet and we do not get our fish up here and the fisheries are closed. And for the last couple of years, we've stood around in amazement with our hands in our pockets when the sockeye fishery has been closed, and at the same time reading in the newspaper when millions of sockeye have been taken by the drift fleet and yet the escapement goals have not been met up here, and we're not able to fish. This needs to be looked at very carefully because the allocation of the resources is, from our point of view, quite out of balance when I'm getting as much as $100 a fish up here, and in many instances not even killing the fish, returning it. And these fish are being intercepted before they get to us. Leaves us wondering whether anybody is really looking at the overall economic impact of sport fishing versus commercial fishing as a part of the tourist industry. And I'll agree with Ron Wilson completely that everybody I talk to come up here primarily to fish, and after they're here, they eat dinner, they stay in very nice lodges, they go on flight scene trips, and they go on river trips, and it is an outstanding, viable industry that has grown up here, and it is based around the sport fishing industry, and I think it needs to be looked at, and it needs to be given a lot higher priority. I would like to see all of Cook Inlet, at least all of Northern Cook Inlet, be given a sport fish priority. Now, exactly what that means and how the fish are allocated, I would leave that up to the biologists. But I would like to see that it would be guaranteed that there would be enough escapement each year that all the rivers will meet minimum escapement goals, and that we, as the last users, would not ever be shut off from using from catching fish. And like I keep insisting, sometimes it's just catching and releasing, but just having the option to catch and release, just because I believe that is one of the most valuable uses of the resource. That is all. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you, Robert, and I appreciate what you had to say, and stay in touch. Do we have any other members, any public testimony from OffNet, or is that it?
That's it.
Okay. Hearing none, we'll go to the audience testimony. We heard from Ricky. Bill McKay.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to speak today. I'm here, as Ricky mentioned, as part of the KRSA nonprofit group. My day job is in another nonprofit industry, that of commercial aviation. I worked for Alaska Airlines, and I'm not seeing too many sympathetic looks.
Had a good time in Juneau this year, haven't we?
We've had a good time in Juneau. It's been another interesting weather year. I'm here to speak briefly to the importance of fishing in general and sport fishing in particular on a statewide basis. Alaska Airlines serves 20 cities in Alaska, all of which support one sport fishery or another. We fly thousands of anglers from all over the world into the state, as well as you might suspect, a large number of Alaskans getting around to different parts as well. We proudly fly our Salmon 30 Salmon aircraft with the King Salmon on its side. There's been some debate as to whether or not that's a commercial or a sport fish. I won't speak to that today beyond for the purpose of today's testimony. It's definitely a Kenai King. And so please let the record reflect that. I believe that sport fishing is critical to the economic viability of aviation in the state overall. It's one of those things that helps supports year-round passenger and cargo service throughout Alaska. I believe that the commercial fishing impact is well documented and that we would be well served if we knew more about the impact of the sports component. And I thank you for your attention.
Thank you, Bill, but some of them willow kings get pretty big, too.
Pardon?
Some of them willow kings can get pretty big, too. any questions for Bill? Thanks, Bill. Ron Rainey?
Mr. Chairman, my name is Ron Rainey. I'm a 25-year resident of Alaska. I live in the Kenai River, and I'm here with Kenai River Sport Fishing, and I'm speaking today for myself. And maybe I can have a little bit different slant on the economics as they're affecting our area. I think Ricky and the rest of the people here have covered it very well. But a person of my age usually is retired from two or three jobs, and I have. But my last one was I ran a full-service fishing lodge in the Kenai River. And we had guests from all over the world, basically from the U.S., every state in the United States, and Japan, Germany, wherever. And my point here is, someone of my age and the business I've been in, what we're seeing on the Kenai Peninsula, it's becoming a retirement community for a lot of those guests that came for sport fishing. And if you'll take a boat, and we'll be happy to take any of you up and down the Kenai River and show you the beautiful homes that now exist on the Kenai River that don't have a lot of impact on the Kenai River. They're set back far enough, they use graded walkways, and they're environmentally sensitive, and they're providing a tax base for our borough, and they're providing an income from that fishing resource all summer long, and no impact on our schools, and no impact on, well, our hospitals. Yes, a few of us die once in a while, but other than that, they're a great asset. Much of our area is a retirement community now, and they're here because of the fishing. We've got to provide the fish for them. Allocation and people that you appoint to these boards are critically important to us. Make sure we have the right balance on the Board of Fish. Make sure we have the right access to the rivers. Make sure our sport fishing community is taken care of. And that's all I have, unless someone has a question.
Thank you, Ron. Any questions for Ron? Thank you.
Thank you.
Rick Berry?
Rick Busey.
Busey. That's right.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, thank you very much for giving me the opportunity to speak. Since 1984, I operated very large-scale retail on the Kenai Peninsula. Typically, on a year-round basis, I would employ 200 people. During the summer, that payroll would increase to 250 to 260. In most retail businesses, as I'm sure many of you are aware, December is the busiest month of the year. On the peninsula, it was July. In most retail businesses, they do not become profitable until the last week in November. On the peninsula, I was profitable by the last week in June, strictly due to the impact of sport fishing. On occasion, when the fishery was shut down, I would lay people off. I would go from a typical schedule of 4,500 man hours a week and cut it back to 2,300 because my volume would drop so tremendously. At one time, before the city of Soldotna had words with me, we allowed people to park their recreational vehicles in our store parking lot. And it was amazing to watch because when the fishery cut off, there was no one there. When the fishery was active, absolutely packed and the whole town just jumped. Ron mentioned the increase in tax base. I have a home on the river. The lot that I bought a number of years back, there's no way I could afford now. It's increased in value from $50,000 to where I'm now paying taxes on a $300,000 lot. The impact on the borough has been huge. The same thing is happening on the Kasilof, and that's entirely due to the fact that people can sport fish successfully. I can stand on my dock and catch my limit of reds in the evening. And that's drawing a lot of people. I'm a retiree, and that's the main reason that I'm living down there as I do. So anyway, thank you very much.
Thanks, Rick, and maybe we'd all like to come down and go to a barbecue at your house.
You're welcome.
And you're right. Bob Penny.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I appreciate being here, and you're talking about something that, if any of you know me, is very close to my heart. I've spent 25 years working on this issue. And I'm going to summarize by saying this to you, that your tourism and economic development, there isn't a single thing your committee or this legislature can do to have more economic impact and strength in the state than one single thing. And that is increase the availability for sport fishing in Cook Inlet. It will double in value in 2 years. You take a pond here and put catfish in it, the people are going to show up. You take a part of the channel and put king salmon in it, I assure you the people are going to show up. They'll be there. The problem with Cook Inlet, even though we're the middle of the population, we have only allowed 15% of the harvest. There's 216,000 licensed anglers in South Central. We get 15% of the harvest. The commercial fishermen take 85. Now, you want to see something changed? Then see that take place. Make that accessibility for the public. There's an it move on now. It's going to the Board of Fish, and it'll be the legislature, an initiative or a referendum that this will has to be take place. That. The way the fisheries manage should be turned around 180 degrees in South Central like it has to the rest of the United States, and that is the public should have the first right to allocation for the fisheries they need. Your family, my family, people that live there should have the amount of fish that they need for their own needs, and the tourists should. Then whatever surplus to our needs could be commercially harvested. That's the way the fisheries got to be changed. And it's going to be coming down to see you in some manner in the next few years because the public's going to want to see that done. So summarizing, I'm saying to you, there was Jones and Stokes did a study in 1986 that we got $320,000 from Governor Sheffield for that showed the economic impact of the fisheries to the, in South Central. Then a king salmon that was caught was $1,118. This is 20 years ago. Economic impact. Any salmon was $110 economic impact. What do you think it is 20 years later today? So if you want to look at something that will really increase the economic impact in our entire state, make more fish available to the public. Believe me, the tourists will come. They have everywhere in the nation you want to. So I hope you listen to this, hear what's going to be coming down the pike further, but it's time to see. And Cook Inlet is different. It's time to see the fisheries change to where we, the public, have a right to the fish we want. Anything else then can be caught and sold, and I thank you for your time.
And Bob, you talked a lot about the Cook Inlet area, but I think that comments can probably pertain to statewide fisheries.
Absolutely.
And thanks, Bob. And unless you want to have any questions from the committee here, Representative Dugan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I've had the opportunity to take a little trip on the Kenai River with Mr. Penny a few years ago and can tell you firsthand that they are building some pretty nice houses along there. I don't know much about fisheries management, but I can tell you from personal experience that the best fishing year I personally ever had was 1989, the summer of 1989, when the Exxon Valdez oil spill closed the commercial fisheries all over South Central Alaska. So I think there's something to this. If they catch them out in the water, they don't get into the rivers idea. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chairman, to the chair, Mr. Chairman, to Mr. Dugan.
Yes, sir.
He touched on a very important point, Mr. Chairman, that Rick Busey touched on. The economic value of the land along the Kenai River, privately held, from Skelak to Ames Bridge, 3 years ago, the assessed value to the borough of only the privately owned land was $335 million. As Mr. Busey said to you, it's increased since then. Now, I know it's well over 500. We haven't seen what the borough's assessed it. But gentlemen and ma'am, all that assessment and value came from one reason, because there's fish in the river. And you put the fish in the river, and you put the fish in the inlet, and you give the opportunity for the public, you see the economic engine run hard.
Thanks, Bob. Any other questions? You know, something here that I'd like the committee to recognize, too, is the economic analysis studies that were talked about by just about everybody who testified, and how we need to make sure those are funded through the state. I think that when we look at tourism as a whole, that's the mandate for this committee to be looking at, is what can we do to help increase these, you know, or to recognize the value of that. And certainly challenge this committee to do all they can to talk to these folks, go fishing with some of these folks. I'm sure they'd love to have you and bend your ear for a while. Take advantage of that and go see what they've got to offer. We also have distributed this Alaska Visitor Statistics Program. It was conducted by McDowell, paid for, distributed through the State Department of Economic Development, or Community and Economic Development. It's got some good information there on fishing in Alaska, where people are coming from, how they get around, and the money that they spend. It's good information. If you have more questions on that, Sally Sadler's in the back here. She'll be glad to talk to you after that, or take a look at it and then give her a call and have her come talk to you about it. Any information in there, I certainly hope you take advantage of that. Do we have any other questions on sport fishing in Alaska?
I do have a question.
Representative Dahl.
I'm not very familiar with the industry, honestly. But do you have a way that you advertise for the sports fishing as a whole? Is there a group or trade association that you use?
Through the chair, I used to be the director of the Kenai Convention and Visitor Bureau, and worked a lot with the new reconfigured industry. Used to be the Alaska Visitor Association, and now it's the Alaska Travel Industry Association. And marketing these days, a lot of that is taking through the internet, through websites. There's travelalaska.org that gets a lot of people, independent travelers coming to Alaska. A lot of the marketing actually comes through cruise ship industry also. They bring a tremendous volume of people up here. They participate in all throughout Southeast Alaska through charter boats on day trips. People are going sport fishing. When they get dropped off in South Central Alaska, either in Seward or Whittier, many of the cruise ship travelers are taking that opportunity to add a week to their vacation, and they'll come down to the Kenai Peninsula up to Matsu and go fishing. So there's in addition to the statewide organizations, there are local organizations that many people belong to. Anchorage Convention and Visitor Bureau, on the Kenai, we have the Kenai Convention and Visitor Bureau, or through local chambers. So people will put out booklets of trying to, you know, you can advertise in booklets, or people will put up their own websites or direct marketing. The advantage in the sport fishing industry is it's a lot, you spend a lot of money getting your first customer, but once you get a repeat customer, you spend less and less on your marketing dollars. And one of the great things about Alaska is our fisheries, and many of our customers are repeat business. That's both people coming in from out of state on a repeat basis, booking the same trips, and then also many people within the state booking trips. And that's one of the advantages of sport fishing in terms of a sustainable industry. We feel that a lot of that advertising costs, it's, you know, you take a while to establish your name, but then once you build up your clientele, many businesses that are established have very few advertising costs because they're so high on their repeat business.
Right. Can I do a follow-up?
Representative Dahl.
What, out of a sort of a typical mom and pop, what would you say is the percentage that they put into advertising?
That again depends upon where you are in your business cycle. Some people may put 10, 20, 30% of kind of their starting up, getting recognized, name recognition, getting out there. Some people will travel to trade shows, whether it's the Anchorage trade shows or Fairbanks or on the peninsula, or they'll go out of state invest that. But once you get kind of up on step with your business and you do get a lot of repeat business coming in, I think that percentage shrinks down over time.
Okay. And just to follow behind that, what of that advertising dollar, how much typically is given to the ATIA?
ATIA is the statewide organization, and I think there's they serve a very vital function. It's important to support that. It gets the name brand recognition out there as consistent marketing. There's quite a few people who do sign up, and you're trying to brand that. You also have more of the regional branding on the Kenai Peninsula. We have the Kenai Peninsula Tourism Marketing Council. There's so many different marketing organizations. I think what in the marketing industry, they've done a good job of trying to get a consistent brand. So no matter what level you buy in, whether it's at ATIA or it's the lower level ACVB, or if you're down at the chambers, your messaging is consistent and you're trying to get people going through the different funnels. And then one of the things about the marketing is that why you need a statewide organization is people just don't come necessarily to one place. They're going to different places and they need sources of information mm-hmm. for that, mm-hmm. lining up their trips.
I actually just have one last. One of the testifiers said that most of his business was actually within the state.
Very often. That's one of the things that is important to recognize when you're looking at sport fishing. A lot of times sport fishing tends to be synonymous with tourism per se, and we look at non-resident bringing people from the outside, but it also serves a very important function for in-state people. People are here, they're drawn here for the quality of life that sport fishing provides to those people, and it's a very large economic driver for the state. So if you didn't have sport fishing here, people could choose to live elsewhere, or they could choose to, you know, retire elsewhere, and it's a very big draw.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Lynn.
Thank you very much. I really appreciate your presentation tonight, everybody, both online and here. And I do like to fish. I hope I'm a better legislator than I am a fisherman, but I do enjoy it. But well, there has to be a balance in all these things. Somebody catches a fish. A sports fisherman catches it, or a commercial fisherman catches it. which fish, you got a nice big fish. Which fish is going to bring the most economic development, the most dollars, the most employment, the most of everything to Alaska? Is that going to be rather either directly or indirectly? So you got one fish, it's going to bring X amount of dollars and employment and everything else. Or me, which one brings the most to Alaska?
Well, if
Ricky, when you answer that question, I know you know the answer. Can you kind of look at it regionally with Southeast, maybe Central, you know, South Central, and maybe Western Alaska?
Wherever you catch a fish in Alaska.
I think it is regional dependent. We in Cook Inlet, obviously the sport fishery, when we did the economic analysis on that, it generates about 10 times the economic engine than does the commercial fishery. So for example, if that one fish was Les Anderson's world class fish that gets its face shown all over the place, or for example, like Senator Murkowski's fish last year that she caught in the Kenai River Classic, and it ends up on Jeopardy. I mean, you we're not paying for that advertising, you know, and that goes
other than there. Senator Murkowski's fish, how does it work?
Just average catch.
On the average catch, again, you know, that one fish on the Kenai River, if it happens to be a Kenai King, can generate thousands of dollars of economic activity. If it's one fish that goes into the commercial tote and we sell it for $1 a pound, if it's a 40-pound King, you generated $40. So, for example, the ex vessel value of the 20,000 Kings that are caught in our commercial fishery on the east side set nets generates around $500,000 of economic activity. In a two-day event in our fundraiser, we invite 200 people here, and that economic just the cost of their room and their travel and other things. We catch a couple hundred Kings during the event. Those couple hundred Kings generate an equivalent amount of economic activity as does a whole commercial fishing for their catch of Chinook salmon there.
Could you, if I may, could you put some of this stuff in writing for some of us? You know, obviously, you know, we have to keep people employed in both industries, and we need both. But you know, what's the balance? The proper balance?
Well, the balance is that we have both industries running at optimum, and I think one of the things in our commercial industries across the state is, at least in the salmon, we've seen the introduction of the farm fish market turn around the whole economics of that farm fish sector. And the commercial industries have been based upon an idea of production. It's the number of fish that we catch. It's not necessarily the quality of those fish that we catch. And what we're trying to see in Cook Inlet is a reorientation so that both industries are producing a quality product. And in the sport fishery, that means that you, when you go fishing on the river systems, you have a meaningful and predictable opportunity to catch a fish, no matter when you come. Because when you book a trip, you may have your 2 weeks of vacation maybe in June or July, but no matter when you come, you have a meaningful and predictable opportunity to catch those fish. So that means those rivers have to have meaningful and predictable pulses of fish to reload those systems every 3 to 4 to 5 days. Now, in the commercial industry, in Cook Inlet, we need to restructure that industry so there's a focus on quality, so that the quality of fish that's produced are grade one fish. And how do we do that? That's the central issue in our industry for as in the commercial industry is we can produce all the grade three quality fish we want, but there's not really a market for it.
And thanks, Ricky. And because we have another presentation to go after this, we need to. But Representative Johansson has a question for you, and then I'd like to ask Bob Penny to come up and answer that question of comparison of commercial codfish to sport codfish.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd just like to echo Representative Lynn's request for something in writing. I know all you folks here are very passionate about what goes on up in Cook Inlet. I'm just afraid that, not to doubt anything that you say, but I'd sure like to see some backup information to back up those numbers. The other portion, the quality issue, something we had Representative Thomas in front of this committee speaking about the quality, and I think that the commercial fleet has for the last few years recognized what you're saying. And at least down in Southeast, they're working extremely hard to increase the quality, which helps your industry as well. And we've really tried hard to get our sport and commercial fisheries to work together. We're not quite as contentious as you folks are up north, and a lot of your issues bleed into my office just because of the nature of my district. But it would be nice to see some data backing up the information that you have testified to.
And in all fairness, too, this chair will try and recognize both sides of this issue. We do have Representative Dahl and Representative Johansson who have fairly large commercial fisheries in their district too. I recognize those as members of this committee, there's two sides to every story. We'll try and look at both sides to that and present as an equal opportunity as we can on all issues. Again, as I mentioned, I think we're going to look again at fishing quotas and fishing, you know, second largest industry in this state. It's huge. So how we divvy up those that fish, you know, how we want to fillet that bugger is going to be critical.
Yeah, I'm not, the issue is not, okay. Not, you know, this industry versus that industry. The issue is what's best for Alaska. What balance comes out best for Alaska, where we can do commercial fishing, and me and my friends can go out and enjoy sports fishing. We need to have both, but you know, how do we do it so it's a win-win? That's what we're looking for. That's what I'm looking for.
Through the chair, it is kind of like a stocks and bonds, and how much are you going to invest in bonds and how much are you going to invest in stocks. And one of our points is that you really do need comprehensive economic data to do that. I will point out through the chair that we did produce this for Upper Cook Inlet. We do have comprehensive information here. It's available for download on our website. And then I'll leave a complimentary copy here with the chair, and we'll try.
And yeah, I think I may have one, but if you could get me another copy of that, Ricky, and if you could get me the information I was asked for by a couple of members here, and you could kind of maybe present that statewide, I'd like to be able to have these committee members have that in their pocket.
And what's your web address?
It's www.KenaiRiverSportFishing.com.
Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions? So Bob Penny was going to come out and talk to us briefly.
Very quickly, Mr. Chairman, through the chair to Mr. Lynn. His question goes right to the heart of the issue. Jones and Stokes, which is a nationally recognized firm in Sacramento, has done three studies 20 years ago across the state. One was done in Southeastern, one was done in Cook Inlet, one was done in Kodiak. And the overwhelming thing carried through on all three of those, almost to the penny, the economic value of sport-caught fish turned in the economy was 14 to 18 times the value of excessive value of a commercial fish will take.
The multiplier factor.
Absolutely. Both, that's not apples and oranges. That's apples and apples. To put that in perspective, the 15% of the salmon that we're allocated in Cook Inlet now, that 15% has more economic value to the state of Alaska than the 85% taken by 1,300 commercial fishermen. If you double that 15%, the commercial fishermen would still get 70%. They'd still make a good living, but it would explode the economic value to South Central. And as you heard earlier, Cook Inlet owes only 3% of the statewide harvest commercially. It's 65% of the public's fisheries.
Thank you.
That was a good way to phrase
enlightened.
That out.
Can I ask one quick question?
Yeah, Representative Johansson, Bob?
Bert.
Or Ricky?
Ricky, either one of you. I'm just wondering, who put this together? Is that your group?
Our organization compiled that information. We did not create any of the economic data in that book. What we did is we looked at all the various sources, and we looked at participation, the economic size, the net economic value, future trends, and we took all that data. It took quite a bit to find. That's one of the problems that we have, is it's pigeonholed in a lot of different sources. And the sources that have been done, such as the Jones and Stokes study was done in 86, the Fish and Wildlife surveys were done in 01, the ICER study was done in 97, and we don't have kind of a real-time series of data being produced and collated in a comprehensive manner.
I didn't see the references page, so sorry, waste of time.
That was mostly ICER.
And I would like to recognize, too, that there's a lot of individual groups. I was on a plane the other day from a fellow from Sitka that was talking about how they want to try and they're working together in their local communities to try and gather information on sport fishing and commercial fishing. And a lot of these groups are trying to get together. Ricky is a good contact for that. Go ahead and get a hold of him or Bob Penny, any of these folks, and he'd be glad to talk to you about that. I know some of the folks from up in the Northern Cook Inlet, my district, have been in contact with them in Southeast, and they're just trying to work together. Any other questions? Thank you, gentlemen, ladies and gentlemen. It's been a
very enjoyable presentation.
A great presentation. Yeah. Okay, next we're going to we're going to be talking about ACARM right now. We're not hearing us. We're not hearing the bill, so if you need to leave, go ahead.
Thank you very much.
At ease.
What about the other folks?
You know, we've just had some legislation on the House floor. This is a good opportunity for this committee members to get a little more informed as to what is actually going on with this issue. It's going to be a big issue for this state, I think, although the title of our today's presentation is ACARM's Economic Impact on the Kenai. It's certainly statewide, and it's going to have implications statewide. We have Lisa Parker and Chris Sonicson. Lisa and Chris, let's get started.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. As the chairman said, my name is Lisa Parker, and I am Government Relations Manager for ACARM U.S., and with me is Chris Sonicson, who is Director of Alaska Operations. our attorneys always like us to put in that these are forward-looking statements and things that you may see in here. So that disclaimer is here. Outline of our presentation, what I'd like to do is give you some background on Agrium as a company overall, and then focus on our Agrium Kenai Nitrogen operations.
And Lisa, committee members, you do have the copy of this. And Lisa, are you going
to
go through this? No.
Yeah, it's clipped.
It's clipped to the back, Bob. It's clipped.
It's underneath.
Okay, excuse me, Lisa.
Yes, sir, I am.
As you're going through this, if you could briefly go through some of this here.
I will briefly go through it.
And committee members, just for the, if you have questions, just go ahead and ask Lisa as we're going along.
Okay. With respect to the history, Agrium has been in business since 1931 and started off as Cominco Fertilizers. It was a subsidiary of Cominco, and many of you know the Cominco name here in Alaska. They came into Alaska in the 1970s, and then in the 1980s developed the Red Dog Mine in northwest Alaska. We are a compilation today of companies that go from Viridian and Sherrod and New West. Recent acquisitions include a company called Newgrow, and then recently Royster Clark. Agrium is a publicly traded corporation and is traded both on the Toronto and the New York Stock Exchange.
Lisa, do you have a value of Agrium's impact, economic impact in the state, or
yes.
is your product-wise?
Mr. Chairman, yes, and I will get to that later in the presentation. As a company, Agrium reaches across the entire value chain. In 2006, our sales were about $4.3 billion. Of that, $2.3 billion was from our wholesale division, and then $2 billion was from our retail division. We also just recently created the Agrium Advanced Technologies, which specializes in specialty fertilizers for turf, home, and garden. We have a very diverse portfolio. You can see that almost 50% of our profits come from the nitrogen industry. You will see both international and North American. The Kenai facility is part of the international component. We also have operations get our revenues from potash operations, two phosphate mines, and then retail. This gives you an idea of our production and distribution facilities in North America as well as South America. As of today, we are only in the Western Hemisphere, but we are looking at developing a nitrogen complex in the Middle East, Egypt to be specific. We have nitrogen operations and wholesale divisions in the United States in both Alaska, Washington, California, Idaho, Texas, and Michigan. And as you can see from this, it is a pretty diverse across the United States and Canada. We also have a nitrogen complex in Argentina that we own 50% of.
So Lisa, going back to the last chart there, you have a lot of connections in Canada, and you said nationwide. And this question goes to the border issues between America and Canada. Is there any issues or concerns there? Have you had any troubles with that, with border crossings or issues like that, or with trying to work in through that?
Mr. Chairman, particularly since 9/11 with Homeland Security, there are some transportation issues. There is more security with respect to truck transport, drivers having security issues there. We also are running into some issues with respect to rail transportation of product between Canada and the United States.
And I ask that question because of the committee members. I'd like to put together a meeting, bring some members from the consulate or ambassadors from Canada in here to talk to us about border issues. Go ahead, Lisa.
As I mentioned, we are also in the retail division. We are a leading agricultural retailer. We are the largest retailer in the United States. And with our acquisition of Royster Clark just over a year ago, we have now approximately just about 450 retail facilities. This gives you an idea of where our retail facilities are. On the West Coast, we operate under the brand name of Western Farm Service, and in both in the Corn Belt and East Coast, it's under the name of Crop Production Services. I'm still Royster Clark because we haven't made the full conversion over to Crop Production Services at this time. Our Advanced Technologies Division, as I mentioned, we just created that in 2006, and that was through the acquisition of both New Grow Company and then Purcell Technologies in Alabama. It has a variety of products that we make, and one that we are continuing to grow is a controlled-release urea, which we call ESN, and it is a controlled release that acts kind of as medicines do, and is all the studies we've done and the growers have shown it is better for the environment in its applications. I'd like to switch to now to the Kenai complex and may let you know that Agrium as a corporation is committed to Alaska, and we are doing everything that we can to continue to try to continue to operate the facility that we have in Kenai. The complex that we have there, if it, we had to rebuild it today, the replacement value would be in excess of $1 billion. It is the second largest nitrogen complex in the United States if it was operating at full capacity. This gives you an idea in terms of the number of jobs that we have, its overall direct impact on the peninsula. I would point out, and you asked this question earlier of the people from the Kenai River sport fishing, for every 1,000 cubic feet of gas that we consume at our plant, it adds $9.35 in total economic output is generated. So it is a large economic engine in South Central Alaska. We also do business and purchase goods and services from almost 400 businesses in the state of Alaska. And we had a study that was completed by the McDowell Group in 2000. They did the study based on 2003 data, completed it in April 2004, that we'd be happy to provide to the committee if you're interested. Our operations today, as many of you know, we have struggled the last few years, and it is based on supply and demand. It is not a function of price. The Kenai complex pays competitive market price for the gas that we use in our complex. It is a supply, demand, and deliverability issue. We have been operating 50% of our plant. We have two ammonia and two urea plants. We today are operating one ammonia and one urea plant, and we have been doing that since November 2006. On October 23rd of last year, we shut down the plant for the winter months because the utilities need the gas during the winter months. And all going well, the plant will restart and start making product again next week. We have, over the last few years, since October of 2005, we have only been able to operate on year-to-year contracts and get year-to-year contracts from all the producers, and the contracts that we have right now will expire in October 2007. We are negotiating with all the producers for gas contracts beyond 2007. We hope that we will be able to negotiate something other than a year-to-year contract to keep the Kenai complex running. This gives you an idea of the gas consumption that we've had. We purchased this facility along with two others from Unocal Agricultural Products in the fall of 2000. The last time our complex operated at full capacity was in 2001. The plant consumes at capacity 53 billion cubic feet per year. And as you can see, since that time, our gas consumption has gone down. This year, we will consume approximately 14 to 14 and a half million cubic billion cubic feet of gas. So we are operating at less than a third of capacity.
And Lisa, something that I discussed with you, and I'd like the other committee members to understand what was going on. Part of that discussion is your need with currently you could use 32 billion cubic feet, I believe you said earlier when we had a discussion, to run at capacity. But Alaska just approved of a contract where we send a lot of LNG to Japan, 76 billion cubic feet?
Approximately, yes, sir.
And you need 32 to operate at full capacity?
Mr. Chairman, we need 53 billion cubic feet to operate the entire complex at capacity.
So herein lies the question. If we're trying to take care of Alaska's jobs and needs, why are we exporting that to Canada? Was it a cost issue? Can you pay the same competitive cost there?
Mr. Chairman, just to correct for the record, the LNG that we export is exported to Japan, not to Canada.
Canada has
more resources than we do here in Alaska right now, or at least online. The export of LNG was done, they have a license and an approval from the Department of Energy to export through 2009, and they have reapplied for an extension to continue that export through 2011. That is a federal approval from the Department of Energy, Mr. Chairman.
But with that discussion that we had, you said that it wasn't an issue. Your issue wasn't purchasing it cost-wise, but it was accessing it, being able to get it. And I just would like committee members to, if you could share that just very briefly, that discussion that you had with me about how we're exporting this gas to Japan when Alaska's needs for jobs right here to create jobs. And I'm trying to get more value added in Alaska, I guess.
Right. And if I might ask Mr. Sonicson, who
just,
is...
Just very briefly on that.
Yeah.
Mr. Chairman, I guess, could I ask you to repeat the question one more time?
We're exporting natural gas to Canada. Our energy department just agreed to continue that arrangement to export to Japan, but when we're not getting enough gas to supply Agrium's needs. You folks told me that it wasn't a matter of cost. You're willing to pay the going rate on the cost, but you just couldn't get access to it. And I'm trying to figure out why we're not taking care of Alaska's needs first and making sure Alaskans have jobs instead of exporting that gas to Japan.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I guess a couple things. First of all, I think what the state of Alaska did through the governor's office administration was to endorse the approval of the LNG extension, blanket extension, with some conditions, and some of those conditions were that the consumers of the state of Alaska were supplied with gas first, and then there was some other situations that the administration asked for before they would recommend that the extension would be approved. But it's a Department of Energy actually approves the extension. From our point of view, we've been negotiating with all the producers, and we feel we can pay, and we are today paying competitive market rates for gas. Nobody is subsidizing our gas purchases today. I mean, it's we're paying competitive rates. We have had a difficult time being able to purchase, as you can see from the consumption curves there. We have had a difficult time purchasing the gas that we need. And I guess it's a business relationship. I can't tell you all the reasons why we haven't been able to acquire more than we have.
That's fine, Chris.
It's basically, but we are able to compete on
that. I just wanted to recognize that so the committee members know that there's some questions about. I have questions on that too. Representative Lynn and Dugan.
You mentioned the administration.
I don't want to get too far off.
Has there been any difference between the last administration and the current administration?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Lynn, difference with respect to
what you're speaking about earlier.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Lynn, I would say the previous administration was was focused on making sure that there was a lot of exploration underway in Cook Inlet. This administration does realize the need that there needs to be exploration underway in Cook Inlet.
That's the same.
Yeah. The current administration is getting their hands on the issues in Cook Inlet. So the previous administration had a few more years to be able to get up to speed on some of the issues.
Representative Dugan.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Would I be correct in understanding that you have the markets to support peak output from the facility, but you don't have the feedstock for it? Is that roughly the correct way to understand the situation?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Dugan, yes, that is correct.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
And Lisa, if you would take the time to talk to each of the committee members on that a little bit further, and then we won't stray too much off of your plan that you have right now, because I think that we're all pretty interested in that discussion.
Yeah.
But I wanted to make sure they were aware of it.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Go ahead, Lisa.
This just shows our production from 2001 to 2007. At capacity, this plant can produce gross almost 2 million tons of both ammonia and urea. And you can see that as a result of the decline in gas being able to purchase the gas has also had an impact on our production. This shows you some of the markets where we sell our product to. And this shows you where our export markets are from 2004 to 2006. I will note that when Agrium purchased this facility in 2000, we exported product to 10 countries worldwide. And today, it's primarily three, with our major countries being South Korea and Mexico. Besides the export market, we meet all of the in-state demand for urea as well. We sell product to the State of Alaska Department of Transportation, and they use that for de-icing in both Fairbanks and Anchorage. We sell it to the farmers in-state, and we also sell a great quantity to Alaska Mill and Feed, and they use that product to make another value-add product, the Arctic Grow and Arctic Melt. And so they use that for their made and get the Made in Alaska logo for the products that they make. This shows the value of our exports by year. In 2006, even though we only operated at 50% of capacity, our exports were just over $160 million. And the facility remained, even though we were down, we are still the state's third largest exporter in terms of value of export behind seafood and mining.
Chairman. Representative Johansson.
You said you put Made in Alaska on the Alaska stuff. Do you put it on all your stuff that goes all over the world?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Johansson, it is the product that is made by Alaska Mill and Feed that puts the Made in Alaska. It's called Arctic Grow and Arctic Melt.
Trying to get some free advertising.
Go ahead.
As you can see, we've been challenged for trying to get gas to keep the Kenai facility operational. And as we move forward, we have been always looking at, we want to keep operating in Alaska. We want to keep doing business in Alaska. And as I said, we have a $1 billion facility. So we've been looking at options and alternatives, which brings us to the Kenai Gasification Project. The project drivers we've gone over, it's due to a decline of natural gas supplies in Cook Inlet. Unless we get additional contracts, we will close the facility later this year. And it eliminates the jobs, the tax base, and the export market for Alaska. What does coal gasification do, and what is Kenai gasification? It capitalizes on a long-term supply of low-cost coal that we have here in Cook Inlet. And we have the abundance of compelling project components with the nitrogen complex that we have, the demand for additional power and alternative power in Cook Inlet. And as I will point out here in a minute, We also may be able to use some of the excess carbon dioxide that we don't use in our urea production for enhanced oil recovery in Cook Inlet. This gives you an idea of what the project is about. We will take coal, and right now we're looking at by rail bringing coal from the Healy coal mine into a port, then barging it into our facility at Nikiski. That coal will be used in a power plant to generate a power, and it will also be used in the gasifier. Through that gasifier, we will then take and get the hydrogen that we need from the air separation unit. We will get the nitrogen that we need, and Chris and the fellows in the plant use their magic, and then from the hydrogen and the nitrogen create ammonia, and then combining the ammonia with CO2, then they create urea. From the gasifier, we will get the CO2. We will have some excess from that that we will use and are examining for use in enhanced oil recovery or other alternatives. We need the power plant because the complex between the air separation unit, gasifier, and our facility, we will need 120 megawatts of power to run those facilities. So we need to build the power plant because there isn't that capacity in South Central Alaska. We are working with Homer Electric, and they are taking the lead on the power project side. We're looking at sizing that facility at about 190 megawatts, so there would be 70 megawatts of excess power that could be fed into the grid without having to upgrade any of the existing power line structures. Our project approach, we started this project in October of 2004, so we've been working on this for the last 2.5 years. And in phase one, which we completed last fall, we did the feasibility study, and we looked at it. Is this something that can be done? And that concluded that, yes, it can. Right now, we're in phase two, which is the front-end engineering and design, and we will start the permitting. Phase three, which would start after the completion of two in the fall of 2008, will be the detailed engineering and final permitting, and we would be looking at the construction and startup in 2009. I will add that this is contingent on us making decisions at various gates along the way that the project still makes sense and is economical. The other is, and somebody said, well, if there's a major find of natural gas in Cook Inlet, you might not have the facilities there to take the gas. All things being equal between coal and natural gas, we would prefer to use natural gas at in our plant, and it can take the natural gas today, but we don't have that natural gas availability in Cook Inlet, and we don't see any hopes with North Slope gas anytime in the next 10 years. Phase one, as I said, we've been working with Usabelli Coal Mine on this project. We completed a detailed feasibility and environmental review. We wanted to make sure, particularly through the environmental review, that there would be no showstoppers, that this project can be permitted. We also examined a couple of different types of technology, the IGCC, which is integrated gasification, and then we also looked at the pulverized coal boiler. We also looked at a range of designs to go forward with the complex. And then at the same time that we were doing these studies, the Department of Energy did some studies in South Central Alaska to look at, is this feasible and does it make sense? And they determined that it did. Phase two, which is where we are today, as I said, Homer Electric's taking the lead on the power side. We are working on final engineering design basis, looking at what the power block configuration should be. I think we're pretty close on the sizing. We are working on the gasification technology and should announce later this year which gasifier company that we will be using, and then doing studies on the plant integration. One of the attributes that we have there is on the plant integration is we have the engineers and we have the expertise there that we can use within our company to work on that integration. We have completed the feedstock due diligence and have determined that Yucabelli and the Healy does have sufficient feedstock. It would be 3 million tons of coal per year that we would need to operate at compliance. Environmental permitting, we will be bringing on the contractor in early May to start the environmental permitting. And we are having discussions now with equity partners for participation. Financing, as the chairman mentioned, you have before you tomorrow House Bill 229, which would provide the railroad with the authority to seek bonds for the project. Of that, $2 billion of that would be for the gasification project that I described to you, the power plant.
Representative Dugan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Lisa, the advantage to going through the railroad is you get lower cost financing because of the tax exemption. But it seems to not be certain that the IRS is going to allow this project to go to sell tax-exempt bonds. Does it work without the railroad's financing if we find out the Internal Revenue Service won't let the railroad do this?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Dugan, it still works without the tax-free bonds. And one of the reasons that in working with the railroad in trying to get the legislation through this year is so that if IRS comes back and says no, you can't use the tax-free bonds, then we start working on the other financing mechanisms.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
One of the other points to make is
on that though, Lisa, doesn't the railroad have a couple of opinions or a precedent to where, because there's a determined a positive economic impact for the state of Alaska, that's why the railroad feels that they can get these bonds?
Mr. Chairman, yes. They believe that they will get a positive ruling from the IRS on this. It does have a positive economic impact on the state, and the railroad is directly involved in the transport.
And through that reasoning is why they feel that they can do this.
Yeah, my question just went to the question of whether this thing just stops dead if the IRS gives us a ruling we don't like. That's all. Yeah. Thanks.
The other point that we have been trying to make members of the legislature aware of is even as we move forward on the coal gasification, this project would come online in late 2011, early 2012. In the meantime, we still need natural gas to keep the plant operating and to keep the workforce that we have there. We realize that we probably are not going to be able to ever get this plant back to 100% capacity on natural gas, but we do want to continue to operate and need to have that bridge of natural gas from now until we're able to make the conversion to coal, if we make the conversion to coal. In conclusion, I just point out that, as I said, phase one of the feasibility showed this works. Phase two, we are continuing. We will, in July of this year, that is our next kind of internal gate to make a decision as to whether or not we will continue to work on this project or not. At this point, things are looking favorable. And as I mentioned, as a company, Agrium is committed to Alaska and wants to continue to do business in Alaska. We have had our challenges, but we're working through those and hope that we can continue to be a part of the Alaska economy.
And obviously you wouldn't have gone this far if you didn't think that feasibility was there. Hopefully we'd like to see that. I know that at least myself personally, Agrium means a lot to Kenai Peninsula. The peninsula itself has had some hard times recently, and the loss of Agrium would be very detrimental to the Kenai Peninsula. I think those are good jobs, average $82,000 a year, I believe he's quoted me, a couple hundred jobs a year. That's a huge economic impact, third largest employer in the Kenai, I believe he said. So, Representative Johansson.
Yeah, we used to have an economy like that. Catch a can.
lots of good high-paying jobs. And that leads up to my question about the environmental feasibility study. And we're talking about coal. You know, some people don't like coal because it's black and dirty. And some people think it's bad for the environment. Do you guys, you did your feasibility study. Are you fairly confident that litigation by whoever just for whatever? I mean, we if you had a 39-cent stamp, you could stop a timber sale. What's the environment around your industry as far as litigation from either environmental groups or other groups that want to stop the project?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Johansson, as I said, we in phase one, we did an environmental analysis to determine can we meet the permitting requirements and are there any showstoppers. We didn't identify any showstoppers. We, with the technology that we're looking at, the scrubbers and the changes, I mean, there's the clean, there is clean coal technology out there and available today that we will be employing. I don't know that there's anything that anybody can do these days to stop litigation, but we are going to be employing in this state-of-the-art clean coal technology. And we have lots of permits that we need to comply with, both from an air quality, water quality standpoint, and we will do what we need to do under the law to meet those permit requirements and to operate a clean facility. One of the things that probably drives Chris, myself, and the others at the plant is, you know, we live in Alaska, and we live in Alaska because we love the beauty of it, and we don't want to destroy that beauty, and we want to operate a good facility.
Representative Johansson?
We used to say that, too, but nobody really listened. But best of luck to you, and I hope you don't run into the problems that we ran into trying to build an economy in our district.
I seen a commercial this weekend on TV, and it was by General Electric, and it played along. There was a country western song that says, I used to be a hunk of coal, and now I'm a diamond. And so hopefully that Agrium can follow along there. And the thing that inspired me, I guess, with that is the fact that it's not just Agrium, but I think the industry in itself, energy companies, are looking to different means. You know, there's gas, there's coal, and I recently had a discussion with somebody, and they stated that one of the primary competitors of natural gas may be coal in the future. But they got some challenges ahead to prove to the people of Alaska that it can be done right, that it can be done clean, and those challenges are laid out fairly clearly, I think, and you're going to have to prove to the people of Alaska that it can be done right, so your work's ahead of you. I certainly think that you have your ducks in a row and you know what you're doing, or you wouldn't be this far. And I wish you success on that. We have been joined back with Representative Dahl. Representative Dahl, just to bring you up a little bit, we've pretty much finished up on Agrium, but I'd like you to be able to contact Lisa or Chris and talk about this issue further. And some of the issues that were brought up. Representative Dugan maybe will share them with you. And thank you, Lisa. Do we have any other questions from the committee?
No, thank you very much.
Yep. Thank you, Lisa.
Thank you.
And that ends tonight's meeting. I'm 7:15.